station promise outstanding content, but when it's time to deliver, they fall flat on their ridiculous faces. Enter LA Talk Radio, a cool, irreverent, and entertaining talk station that delivers totally original content without any commercials. Log on to latalkradio.com and get involved with the best talk radio station on the internet. LA Talk Radio, we say what we want.
This station presents Real American Heroes.
Real American Heroes.
Today, we salute you, Mr. Three-Day Weekend Survivor.
Mr. Three-Day Weekend Survivor.
Another long holiday weekend is over, and you regale us with tales of woe.
You did too much yard work, too many projects, too much running around, but you didn't get enough rest.
Gee, you never worked that hard around here.
Really, man, we don't care.
And need a break from your whining, yeah.
So the next time the martyr of the mini-vacation shows up late and says, I need another long weekend to recover from my long weekend, don't strangle. Instead, salute Mr. Three-Day Weekend Survivor, a real American hero.
Mr. Three-Day Weekend Survivor.
No, it's not Friday yet, you slacker.
Get ready for the best morning show on any kind of radio. Broadcasting live from the palatial studios of LA Talk Radio, get ready for Sam and Kara in the morning. Give Sam and Kara a call at 323-203-0815. And now, here are your hosts, Sam and Kara.
Wow, it's so weird to be back, huh?
Oh my gosh, we're back!
July 6th, today is Tuesday, after a long weekend, and we're back live.
After 2 weeks.
In the studio, after 2 weeks, for crying out loud.
It's been a really long weekend.
It seems
we took
like
that long,
a long
weekend.
Time,
we
huh?
took that long weekend and we ran with it. Like, 4 days, 2 weeks.
I know. People are like, what's going on? You haven't archived your page. I wrote them. I said, we've been on vacation, my friend.
We've been on vacation, my friend. Okay, so speaking of vacays.
Uh-huh.
How was Israel?
It was good. We'll talk about it and stuff.
Yeah.
We have an exciting show today. We have two authors. One is going to be Bill Press, who used to be here on radio and television in L.A., and now he's in Washington, D.C., I believe. And he's a liberal talker, and we're going to talk to him about his new book called Toxic Talk. And we're also going to have an author named Christopher Rice. He happens to be the son of Anne Rice.
Oh, wow.
If you know her.
Yeah, of course.
And he's an author in his own right. And so he's going to be in the studio. And,
oh, cool.
You're going to enjoy this. He's very, very handsome.
Oh, really? Am I?
Yes.
Well, I got my red, white, and blue on today for him. You ready, Christopher?
Are you wearing red, white, and blue today?
Yeah,
well, you got stars and you got red. Oh, yeah, you do have blue as well.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Proud to be an American.
Very nice.
At least I know I'm free. I just got back from Texas, so I'm rocking some red, white, and blue.
Yes,
I actually
yes.
Wore this on the plane, slept on it last night, and here I am, people. Nice, fresh out the oven for you. Rocking a little heat.
So these are not the same clothes you wore yesterday, or is it?
No, it is.
Oh, it is?
Yeah.
Did you wear it on the plane?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. You better sit far from me because
No, I mean, I smell good. I make sure that, you know, the heat is on. I make sure that it's... I smell good. I always smell good.
Yeah, well, you know, it's not the same. After I was done with my flights 20 hours later,
oh, yeah.
I was smelling like shit.
Oh, I bet.
Yes.
I bet, because that's how long is it?
Yeah, it was about 20 hours worth of flights to come back here.
Seriously? Oh, man. Yeah, see, my flight was 3 hours.
Really?
Three and a half hours.
Yeah, that's nothing.
That's nothing.
I mean,
that's like, you know, a drive.
And I came from a humid place, too. So by the time I was on the plane, I was already sweaty and stinky.
Oh, that's good.
And, then
paint the picture a little more for us, Sam.
Yeah,
I will. Did your butt crack itch? Did you have butt crack sweat?
Actually, I wasn't aware of that, but maybe it did. Who knows?
Probably did. A little butt crack sweat. Oh, nasty.
Yeah. So you spent the whole 2 weeks in Texas, huh?
I did. I had such a great time.
Wow.
Oh, man. I feel so... But I'm so grateful to be back. I'm just like, thank you, God.
Isn't it great to be back home?
I am so... I just feel blessed. I feel like sometimes you have to leave and then kind of get a different perspective. And then I come back. I'm like, man, God is good. I just feel... alive. I feel excited by the city.
Mm-hmm,
but it's good to leave because when leave, you get a different perspective and you get refreshed. And, you know, Texas is salt of the earth type people. I mean, it's just, it's so down home. It's so wonderful. It's relaxing. And people just spend time with on the little things, you know, they talk.
Yeah.
They talk to strangers. They enjoy life. And it's just so great. And then you come back here and you just start talking to everybody more than I already do.
Yeah.
Which is
a lot. So you got a chance to relax as well.
Yeah. Good. I had a great time. I ate like crazy.
Did you really?
Ugh. Sam, I took the gloves off.
You did,
I was like, you know, well...
What was the occasion now? I mean...
I just went... I was gone for 2 weeks. I went and saw friends and family. If you've been to Texas, the food's amazing. Mm. It's not just amazing. There's a lot of heart. The food has heart.
Oh, it does. And soul, too?
Oh, man. Heart and soul. So when you go in... I mean, I had fried boudin balls. Have you ever had those?
No.
I'm going to make them. We need to have, like, a little throwdown. It's boudin, which is, like, a sausage, cheese, and rice all in sausage mixture.
Uh-huh.
And then they fried it. Which is amazing. Fried boudin balls.
Mm-hmm.
And then I had tons of different stuffed jalapenos. Have you had those?
No.
Oh, damn.
Really?
Damn. Yeah.
Those must be real hot, though.
No, they're not. Because you clean out the inside of the jalapeno, so there's not the seeds,
which are hot.
I see. And then it's got cream cheese. It usually has like some shrimp in there, and then they fried.
Wow.
Woo! But everybody, you
is
know.
Is this like Texas food?
Yeah.
Really?
Man, we have barbecue.
Wow.
Oysters. I'm trying to tell you, and I was like, okay, when I get back in town, I'll get back to the anorexic plan, and I'll work out and, you know, do a master cleanse or something stupid like that.
Yeah.
And I'm already ready to cook.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I'll have to put
it back.
See,
where I went, there's a lot of food that I like and stuff, but I sort of watched what I ate.
Did you?
Yeah, and I wasn't that hungry most of the time. I don't know why, but maybe because it was hot.
That has a lot to do with it, yeah.
Yeah, so I actually didn't gain any weight, so I'm
really?
Pretty happy about that, yeah.
But what about, I mean, was there anything delectable that you had to have? You're like,
yes,
oh, I gotta have
yes, like falafel and shawarma I had to have a lot of, you know?
So it was good. So you got your shawarma on.
Yes, but they've got a lot of great stuff. I mean, I spent a lot of time in coffee shops and stuff because I needed internet connection.
I know.
And my parents don't have it. You know, that's where I was staying. They don't have any internet. So I had to go to the coffee shops all the time and do that. So I would, you know, drink a lot of coffee, eat stuff and that. Like, pastries are amazing.
So how was it?
It was amazing. It was really good, you know. Although I never really get that excited about being in Israel, you know, because there's a lot of things that irritate me, you know. I mean, I can get irritated.
You told me that before, but I thought, he'll get over it. But how was it?
No, so, I mean, I was still irritated about the same things, you know, mainly the drivers and that. But for the most part, I had a great time. You know, I spent time with the family. Then I met up with my daughter, who went on a trip there separately, and then we met for a few days.
Yeah.
And she was staying with us. And it was just amazing, you know. I never, like... pictured myself being in the places that we went to together, you know, because...
Oh, that's so sweet.
Yeah, so it was just a great time. You know, we went to Jerusalem and we went to the old city there.
Yeah.
Do you have a desire to be in Jerusalem?
I would love to go see it. I don't know if it's one of those, like, back to Zion type feelings, but it's definitely something I would love to. How was it for you?
Well, look, I mean, Jerusalem is very modern on the one hand and very ancient on the other.
You know? I mean, I would love to go, but I think that there's a, like you said, there's kind of a deeper feeling for some people because it's the Holy Land or whatever.
Right.
And so they've got to get back to it because... I don't know why, but
yeah, but for most religions, it's
it's a crossroads
religions.
For many different faiths.
And,
you know,
and people really get attracted to that place, you know. So
I would love to go for
tourists,
historical reasons, and because I've heard it's just beautiful. And
spiritually, I mean, you really feel spiritual there.
Did you feel spiritual?
No, I didn't, but most people.
I wasn't really tuned into that frequency, but there were other people there.
Yeah.
I just think God is everywhere. So when I look at it, I kind of like, you know, God is here.
But that's sort of a direct line to God over there.
Oh, okay, the red phone's there.
There's no operator in the middle.
Okay, there's no middleman. Okay, well, maybe I have to check it out. So Jesus is there. He's like saying, what's up?
Jesus is there, I'm sure. Yeah.
I'm sure he is. He's everywhere, though.
Yeah. So, you know, so we walk around in the old city, and it's all like very narrow alleys and, you know, very old, very, you know, and it's all like Arab merchants selling garbage, pretty much. You know?
Really?
Like cheap stuff, you know, like souvenirs
mm-hmm,
and that.
Yeah.
But then, you know, all the smells in the air, you know, both good smells and odors and that, it's part of the experience, you know?
Yeah.
And they keep on, you know, trying to get you to buy shit from them and stuff. So it's fun, you know, it's a lot of fun. And there's food there, but people told me be careful of the food over there because...
In Jerusalem?
Yeah, not in Jerusalem, but in the Arab section because it's not very hygienic there, you know. So,
oh, really?
Yeah, so... Oh. But yeah, and then we went. The highlight of the trip really to Jerusalem was Yad Vashem. Have you heard of that? That's the Museum of the Holocaust.
Oh, really?
And I mean, if you want to really be moved for the rest of your life, that's where you go. You know.
Yeah.
And have you ever seen Schindler's List?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I mean, that kind of like is brought to life, you know. And it's like you go on and it never ends, and you know, displays of everything and films from back then, and you know, it's just, and there's one huge circular room that holds all the names of 6 million people that were killed.
Wow.
That were murdered during the war. And my daughter just couldn't believe. She says, look at this huge place, and you know, it's all like pages and pages of names of people. And you know, I mean, just the enormity of it all is it makes you stop and think. It really does, you know. And so, you know, if it interests you, you know, I mean, that's the kind of thing where you see from the rise of anti-Semitism and the Nazis and that, you know, all through the war, and how countries would not take Jews, you know, because they didn't want to get involved and all that. So, you know, without getting into too much detail, it's very powerful there, you know. I mean,
yeah,
you go there and you never forget that. You
wow.
never forget what you see.
Man, I bet so, that's really, really moving. I mean, I know the movie was moving. I remember, I think even in like junior high, we went to some Holocaust museums in Texas, and they showed you stuff. And
in Texas, they have Holocaust museums.
There's probably, I think there were maybe not a Holocaust museum, but like sections, you know?
Right, like Museum of Tolerance or something.
Yeah, things like that. But I mean, I remember it just, you know, as a kid, and you look at those images and stuff, it's really, it's just so graphic, and it's so dehumanizing. You're like, wow, that's, it's just hard to wrap your brain around it. I don't think you can.
Yeah.
I don't really think, you know, I don't think we're meant to wrap our brain around it because it's,
yeah, it's
so
too much.
Unnatural. It's so, you know.
Yeah, it's too much, you know. And it's definitely not something that you go to have fun.
No, but it's,
you know, but it's something that I think stays with you for a long time, you know, because you realize these are people, you know, these are all people doing things to people, you know, that are like unimaginable, you know.
Yeah.
So at any rate, but on a positive note, you know, we had a lot of fun, and my daughter went out. She met a few of my cousins and stuff. I guess I have some cousins that are her age. You know?
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, interesting. So did she end up, I know that at first she got there, she was a little shaky, and then she like started having fun?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah,
so she's having a good time with it?
That. Yeah. Yeah. In the beginning, she was, it was kind of hard for her in the beginning, you know, because she's never really been away for that long. So, but then she started hooking up with people and she had a great time, you know.
Oh, that's so good. Was she so glad you were there?
Yeah. Yeah.
Aww,
she couldn't wait for me to
get there. Her dad was there. That's sweet.
Yeah. So that was a nice bonding time for us.
Oh, that's so sweet, Sam.
Yeah. It was really cool.
Bet y'all had
a
good time.
Yeah. I showed her where I grew up, where I was born, you know, and it was just amazing. It was a long time coming, you know.
And what about you? I mean, going back and revisiting like where you lived and everything like that.
Yeah, it wasn't, you know, I mean, it wasn't that exciting for me because I was only there about 8 months ago, you know, so it was still pretty fresh. And but I did get to see people and friends and family. Like I said, I didn't really go there to do any tours or anything.
Yeah, well, how was it reconnecting with friends and stuff? Was it good or was it weird or what was it?
Well, most of them, it's like, you know, most of the time I didn't really even feel like connecting with anybody, you know, so it's a friend or two. But I did spend a lot of time with my family, you know.
And how was that?
That was good. It's always good. You know, your parents get older, you want to spend more time with them, and and it becomes more meaningful, you know.
Is it weird when they get older? It's just kind of hard to adjust, huh?
It is.
Is it weird seeing your family like, wow, this is my mom and my dad, and they're like.
Yeah, yeah. You know, and as you get older, you get sick and, you know, things like that. You don't move around as easily.
Yeah, I'm noticing that with my family a little bit.
Yeah.
And it's weird. It's so weird because my aunt raised me, and she was in her like late 30s, 40s when she started raising me, and now she's in her 50s, which isn't that old, but there's just things that I just see her eternally as like a 35-year-old.
Really?
Yeah. So there's certain things where she's like, oh, okay, well. And I'm like, no, don't you well me. I'm like, come on, we're going. Like, that's the attitude I have with her. But she's still spunky and spicy, but there's just things. I mean, she had a brain aneurysm, so she's still recovering from
really?
That. Yeah, I mean, you can't really be hard on somebody that had a brain aneurysm.
Yeah, and then you come in and bounce off the walls and
yeah,
stuff.
Yeah, like, hey. But yeah, she has a real problem with my clothing.
Really?
Oh, my gosh. She's just constantly like, your shirts... You've got too much cleavage. Your skirts are too short. And I'm like, okay, it was kind of cute at first. Like, she's my mm-hmm. mom. Like,
right.
Kind of, you know, and she can get away with that saying that because, you know, she's like my mom. But she wouldn't quit. And I said, finally, I was like, look, you just have to respect people's choices. You don't have to agree with it. You just have to respect the fact that you can't control people and
right.
that we all have different choices because this is making it not fun.
Right.
Because I'm not going to stop wearing what I want to wear.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm living...
So you didn't always used to dress like this? I mean, as you grow...
It's not really much different. It's yeah. just I think that, you know, you leave, you become more liberated, and I live in a different society where, you know, it's sunny all the time,
mm-hmm.
and... wearing little skirts and tank tops and stuff is kind of normative.
Mm-hmm.
And then you go back to a society that's way more conservative, and it's not always sunny all the time. And, you know, then you're hanging out with people that are older and different generations. There's
yeah.
a lot of stuff going on there. I'm not asking for you to think it's right or okay. I'm just asking you to respect the fact that this is my choice.
Right.
That's it.
Yeah.
It's called tolerance.
So you were wearing the same clothes over there and everything.
Yeah,
and
I was having a blast.
Like, yeah.
I was having a blast. I mean,
so did anybody else comment on it? Or
no.
Just your aunt?
Just my aunt.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I love her. I mean, I just know that she's not into it. But I also think that, you know, there's a weird kind of conservative thing where people are like, you know, modesty in a way that I don't agree with. I think modesty is like really kind of equates in my mind to humility of really just not being full of yourself and being about being other-centered.
Right.
But I mean, celebrating the way you look and feel, I don't think is necessarily bad.
No, not at all.
And sometimes I do push it and I cross the line, but I'm learning, you know. But mm-hmm. you also have to give people room to kind of figure out where that is.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you have to, you know, I mean, she's protective of you, you know.
Yes. And but it's so funny, Sam, because we were like out and, you know, I mean, yeah, I know I'm a good-looking girl and I'm built. And if I get, and I put on a little weight, nothing major, but if I put weight on, I get more built. I just look like this really big, like voluptuous, like da 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 da. It gets obscene. It gets like very like Anna Nicole Smith. And anyway, so we'll go out and I'm just, you know, wearing what I wear, you know, having a good time and wearing my clothes and, you know, guys look or whatever, but that's just men. Men look at women all the time.
Yeah.
I mean, I just think that's just how they're wired.
Yeah, but you still don't realize that the way you dress does attract attention, right? Bless you. It does attract attention.
Excuse me, guys.
Yeah.
No, I mean, but I was in a bar. It was an outdoor patio with really cool bands and, you know, margaritas, and mm-hmm. it was 4th of July.
Yeah.
You know, whatever. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm not going to wear a shawl. I'm not going to wear a shawl or
yeah.
a burqa.
No, anyway. I mean, you wear what you want.
Exactly. Like, but she's like, yeah. she's like, Kara, she said this to me a couple times. I laughed my ass off. She said, because I have had on my skirt. This mm-hmm. sounds so tacky. She's like, Kara. She's like, are your legs good, tat closed, rat, good? I said, what? Are your legs tat closed? I was like, who the hell talks like that? I said, I think I can manage this. She's like, because those guys are looking. And I was like, it doesn't matter. I got a wax. We're good. I'm sorry. We're set. Don't worry. I just got a wax. No, I'm just playing. Of course they were closed. But it just, she was uncomfortable with that attention.
Right.
And so it made her feel awkward. And but it's just so funny. She's like, are your legs closed? I was like, no, there's a for sale sign there.
Yeah,
no.
The spread wide open.
And I said, and my legs are a little chunky right now. So they're all smashed together, touching. There's no room to see anything. We're set. I got this under control. It was really funny. But another thing that's weird is that I went on vacation. And you guys, if you go to Texas, just have fun. Eat like crazy. Just do it.
Mm.
You owe it to yourself. But the food is amazing. And the culture is so much fun. And I was on like, I'm going to eat what I want. I'm not going to withhold, you know. I'm just going to have fun and enjoy the food and everything. And it's vacation. Well, it seemed like I was around all these people that were like dieting.
Mm-hmm.
And nothing pisses me off more when I'm trying to get my throwdown on and somebody's counting the carbs and stuff right next to me while I'm trying to enjoy my throw.
Oh, God.
You know, I'm like, I finally had to tell my brother. I was like, look, I live in L.A. This is a typical everyday. This is counting calories, carbs, sugar, whatever, and your workout is the way of life there. It's kind of nice to get out of it and just have freedom and just do what you want. And it's vacation. So, you know, so I basically was like, look, when you go to Texas, just take the gloves off, get your eat on, and go back to your anorexia later or your bulimia. Whatever it is your choice, just do it later. But I had an amazing time with friends and family. Went to Austin first, Austin, Texas.
Did you really?
Yes. And it's really sweet. Austin has a very rural, hilly vibe, and there's an artsy vibe. It's kind of hippie-ish a bit. We went to Schlitterbahn, which is a huge water park, and we went to some great bars and great food, and we went to this place where they had a Texas winery and did some wine tasting, and it just feels like very open, like the space and the skyline's open. And it's just refreshing to kind of get away. And I felt so good, you know, leaving, and everybody talks to everybody. It's just sweet. It's really sweet.
Yeah. So you went to a water park. What's that all about?
Man, freaking water park. It's right on the river, so they use the river water.
Oh, really?
Probably a little nasty, but they you go down all these big slides and tubes and, you know, it's really funny.
Aren't you a little too old for that, though?
No. No, adults go and stuff. It's like a renowned water park in the U.S.
Oh,
so a
really?
Lot of people travel all over to go to it.
Really?
Yeah. It's not like a kid water park. It's like everybody kind of goes.
Yeah.
And I'll still go even if it's a kid water park. Don't test me. Don't try me. Unfortunately, when I got to Houston, because then I went to Houston, it rained a lot.
Oh, really?
Yes, it rained a lot. And I was like, it was like tropical.
It's humid, right?
Well, it was, they had another hurricane come in that was coming in towards Mexico and South Texas, and then it was going to possibly move up the coast. So we started getting like these crazy flood watches. I'm like, oh, okay, welcome to Houston. This is my vacation.
Yeah.
They're like, they have signs that say, fill up your gas tank, because it's serious, the past hurricanes, where people will go to a gas station and wait in line, people's cars overheat, and they blow up.
Wow.
They run out of gas.
So people prepare for the time when there's a hurricane and they fill their gas.
Yeah, they kind of over-prepare people now, because the last one was so devastating that a lot of people didn't, they were backed up on the freeways, people couldn't evacuate. It was really bad. It was really bad, like people sat in traffic for 2 days type
thing.
Really? Yeah, jeez. Like literally bumper to bumper. So people's cars overheated and everything.
Right.
It was good. And it was good to see some family. I really got to reconnect with some family. Family's tricky, though, because it's like you kind of leave. I'm sure you know this. It's like you leave and you do your thing, and it's different. And you come back, and the way of life isn't different for them.
Right.
Not that I'm better or anything like that, because it's not. But there's kind of a clash.
Mm-hmm.
And I find that there's like a little like lack of tolerance. It's
really?
Yeah, it's kind of weird. It's kind of weird. It's like, why aren't you doing this? Why don't you do this? Why don't you look like this? I'm like, lay off.
Really?
You know,
so people had things to say about the way you dress and
well,
way
that's a small thing.
Right.
It's just the little nitpicking kind of like, you know, everybody's got an opinion, and it's just, you know, shut up.
Yeah.
Be grateful I'm here.
Well, that's what family is for, you know, to give you shit.
I don't know, man. My view on family is a little different, because I have a very unconventional like connection with my family, and
right.
I don't really believe in forced relationships. So if you didn't have a relationship with somebody growing up and they're not making an effort in your adult life and you don't really want a relationship,
right?
Why force it? It's not an angry thing. It's just kind of like, hey, we don't really know each other. You're not calling me. I've never called you.
Right.
Why do I have to feel guilty? Because people want to make you like, I don't know. It's really weird. I don't want to have to sit there and pretend that we have, you know, a comfy, cozy relationship. It's like, we don't have to do this.
Yeah.
You know, even the Bible, because, you know, the Christian culture, it's like the Bible says, better is a friend that is near than a brother that is far. And if you look at the life of Jesus was approached by people that said, oh, your brother and your mother are looking for you. And he goes, who are my brother and my mother? He goes, everybody's my brother and my mother. And that really, family is what you make it. It's not this, oh, we have to be together because we have the same blood. It's like, what does that mean? The people that have been there for me in my life, 90% of them have not been family.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so it's kind of like, it doesn't mean I disregard it. It's just that it's so much bigger than that.
Right.
I just look at it differently. And that, I think, offends people.
Yeah.
But it's just a broader way of looking at it.
Yeah. It's true. So, I mean, is there any family other than your aunt that you're close to?
Yeah. No, my brother. I went to go see my brother. And I have another aunt. She's really cute. She lives next door to my aunt, the one that I stayed with. These two aunts live next door. Really, really fun people. And we just had a great time. They just have hearts of gold. These what leads my ants are just so cool. Hearts of gold.
That's
they're
nice.
They're feisty. They're fun.
Yeah.
You know, I love them to death. And my brother, he's crazy. My brother's really, really funny.
Mm-hmm.
I saw my dad for a little bit, just like high and by, 2 minutes.
Yeah.
My dad has a barbecue business.
Right.
It's kind of cool. He's doing really well.
Really?
Yeah, he's got a barbecue business. He works it every day.
What's a barbecue business? I mean, does he cook?
Yeah, they smoke. They've got like 3 or 4 or 5, I don't know, like 5 different smokers where they smoke meat and they sell barbecue sandwiches and barbecue stuffed baked potatoes. That's damn good.
Really?
Oh, my gosh. Get yourself a baked potato stuffed with barbecue. Woo! I'm getting hot just thinking about it. Getting hot and bothered. That food is damn good. I'm not going to lie. They got like got all these different pies and stuff.
Yeah.
I'm telling you, you walk into Texas, you instantly gain 10 pounds. But it's the way it should be. It's a different kind of fat there. It's like happy fat.
Happy
like
fat.
In L.A., it's shameful.
Does it
shameful.
Look different, too?
It feels different. Let me tell you. In L.A., it's a shameful, why'd you do that kind of fat. And Houston or Texas, it is just a happy fat. You're just happy and you're like, And I reconnected with my ex-boyfriend, who we did this trip together with a bunch of my friends. And we had a great time. We really, really hit it off again. We were together for 5 years. You know, I met him when I was 19.
Right.
So, and we were totally in love and wanted to get married and everything. I moved here. Mm-hmm. He stayed there and, you know, yada, yada, yada.
But there's still a fire there?
There is. It's interesting how it doesn't go away.
Oh, wow.
You know, and it's been years.
That's interesting.
Yeah, we hadn't seen each other in years.
Yeah.
So.
Well, maybe because you didn't break up on bad terms, right?
No, I mean, it was rough because it was 5 years and I moved and we tried to do 4 of the years long distance, which sucks, you know.
Right. And, but it's not like you fought it and hated each other and stuff.
No, we didn't, but it was hurtful because, you know, there's so much, you invest so much into a person.
Right.
And I know that that's how he felt and that's how I felt. So, but it was, we just had a great time. We had so much fun reconnecting.
That's cool.
And, yeah, we did that. And
you didn't do the skydiving thing.
No, we ended up not doing it. So,
yeah.
But that, it just, we ended up taking
good
off.
Good for you, yeah. I was afraid I'd lose you.
No! Bye, Sam and Sarah in the morning. No. But, you know, what's fun is that, you know, it's really fun being in a society that, like, men like real women out there. I mean, they just, Texas men like big women. They like women, women's.
So a real woman is a big woman? Is that
I don't mean
saying?
Big like overweight, but I just mean, you know, not size
healthy.
Zero. let's identify. But like I was wearing a bunch of these skirts and I had like a real cinched in belt and I, you know, had been eating a little bit more than usual. So I had a little bit of like fluff on the, like I had a little bit of back fat, I guess, that was like kind of popping out a bit and with my tight shirt. And I was like, oh shit, where did that come from?
Oh God.
And you know, the guy that I was with, he just loves it. He just gets on it and grabs it. He's like, he just grabs it. Like,
well, that's good. Somebody likes it.
Yeah,
huh?
but it's kind of a sweet way to look at people.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I'm gonna go hike and run today, but whatever.
You got a lot of catching up to do, huh?
Yeah, I know.
Did you do any running there?
A little bit, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I feel good. It was just fun to kind of go there and just it felt open and free and, you know, go to Texas, you'll like it, people. It's so fun.
Hmm.
It's such a great place. People are.
Well, it sounds like you had a lot of fun. That's cool.
I did.
Yeah.
I did. I had a good time.
So, I mean, did you feel you had enough, or did you feel
yes,
you wanted to
stay
more?
Me rephrase that. Let me kind of recap. So, I had a great time. I got to see friends and family. But coming back to L.A., it just feels right, and it feels like a fit. And there's just so much going on here. I'm so grateful to be here. I just was thanking God this morning. I was like, you know, life is good. I don't know how I make it, but I love it. I have such amazing friends here, and I just...
It's good. At least you're where you want to be, you know?
I'm really grateful. I just am so grateful. I mean, I really am. I have so much to be grateful for. I just thank God that I, you know, I have so many people that love me and just fun times, and, you know, all I know is I was driving here today, and I was just going down my usual drive and just happy to be in my drive. And and I was just thinking, yeah, we're all on a one-way ticket in this life. We are.
Oh, yeah.
I was like, who knows where I'm going to be, you know, down the line. But I'm just going to enjoy life and thank God for everything I have.
Yeah.
And just
that's
grateful.
The thing, like you said, you know, it's good to get away every once in a while because then you appreciate it more.
You really do. You
and,
really do.
You know, it's easy to get tired of L.A. sometimes and badmouth it and stuff, but... You know, it's really a cool place. You know,
I mean,
it's home for us.
I really love it. What about you when you came back from Israel? Did you have that feeling of, oh, I'm so glad to be back?
Yes, definitely.
I saw your Facebook post said something like, I wanted to kiss the ground. Yeah. Like, was it that bad? Or were you just tired of being in the flight?
No, I mean, it's just, you know, being 4th of July and everything. I just felt proud to be here, you know.
Aww.
And it's, yeah, I missed it. I missed home, you know. I mean, there's so many things we take for granted here, you know, that once you're away, you start to appreciate them more.
Mm.
Because you're able to look at it from the outside.
Mm.
Yeah. So I'm happy to be back. Yeah, I haven't been able to sleep that well though because you know the jet lag. It's
oh,
like
oh man.
Yeah, I mean because it's like a difference of about 10 hours. You know, so you're talking about when it's nighttime here, it's daytime there, and vice versa.
So what time did you go to bed last night?
Well, the night I got here, I went to bed at 4 and got up at 6 in the morning.
Oh, 4
yeah,
in the
2 hours. No, 2
oh,
hours.
Oh, just two
of sleep.
Hours.
Yeah.
Really?
4 a.m. till about 6:30 a.m. And then I got a little bit of a nap yesterday in the afternoon. And then tonight, I mean, or last night, I went to bed at about 11:30, got up at 2:30, couldn't sleep anymore.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so it's pretty weird. But that's fine because I feel energized and everything, you know. And
did you so miss Dina so much?
Yes.
Oh, man, were you so happy to see her?
Yeah, I was happy to see her, you know.
Oh, that's so
sweet. Yeah, we were in constant touch, you know, phones, Skype, all that stuff all the time. But, yeah, I was glad to be home.
Oh, that's so precious.
Glad to be home, yeah.
That's so precious.
So that's pretty cool, yeah. So, okay, well, we're not going to take a break because we don't really have time for one at this point. So we're going to call Bill Press, and he's a talk show host in Washington, D.C., and we're going to talk to Bill Press. I'm looking forward to this. The book is Toxic Talk, by the way.
Go Press.
Bill, good morning to you. Sam and Kara in L.A. How are you
Hi,
doing
Bill.
This morning?
Hey, I'm doing good. Thank you. Are you guys ready to go?
Yes, we're on the air.
You're live.
Are you? Are you ready?
Absolutely. This is my cell phone. I was just going to give you a landline number, but if we're on the air and this sounds good,
yeah.
Let's go.
Well,
hey,
good. You know a little bit about radio, so that's good. We appreciate that. That's fine. The cell phone is fine. I remember you, Bill, from back when you were on TV here in L.A., and I know now you're in Washington, D.C. Is that correct?
That's right. Boy, if you go back to my TV days in L.A., that's a long time ago.
Yeah, you're talking
that's
about...
started.
Yeah, 1980s, I believe. And so when did you move to D.C.?
I was in L.A., you know, I did KABC is where I started.
Right.
And then I moved over to KCOP, and I did talk radio at KFI.
Right.
And I came back here in 1996 to do Crossfire. At CNN. That's when I got the job at Crossfire.
That's right. And how long did you do that for?
I did that for, just quick, I did that for 6 years and then went over to MSNBC with Pat Buchanan and we did a show there. And then I've been doing my own national radio show for the last 5 years.
5 years, wow. And are you here on a local station as well that we can hear you on? What station are you on?
On K-Talk 1150, my show is 6 to 9 a.m. East Coast time, morning drive. So in Los Angeles, that makes it the early, early show, 3
right.
to 6 a.m.
There you go. So are you enjoying D.C.? I mean, do you feel you're in your element now? I mean, you're obviously into politics and that you're close to where everything's happening.
You know what? If you... are into politics and the media, right?
Right.
Washington's really the place to be. You know, I've joined the White House press corps, so I go there almost every day. Every day there's a briefing. There's no briefing today, but and you know, I do my radio show from here. I'm able to get a lot of good guests on, senators and members of Congress, because I'm right on Capitol Hill,
right.
just down the street from the Capitol building. Mm-hmm. At the same time, you know, it's a very one industry town, you know, and meaning politics.
There you go. Yeah.
Does that get a little nauseating? Is it a little nauseating? Is it a little nauseating, Bill?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, sometimes, believe it or not, I like to have a conversation that's not about politics.
It's kind of like L.A. You get tired of talking to a lot of actors that are talking about their latest acting class and their headshots, and you're like, can I just talk to a banker right now or a librarian?
No, No, exactly. You know, I love L.A. I lived there 9 years, and mm-hmm. but it's like that's a one industry town too, right?
Which, there you go.
Hollywood.
Right.
Yeah.
Well,
and every waiter, it used to be when I was there, every waiter had a screenplay, you know.
Really? Just ready in their back pocket.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. I saw you at the New Media seminars a few months ago. I never got a chance to talk to you, but I know you were sitting on a panel and everything, and you seem to be in the minority as far as political opinions and stuff. So, which takes us to your book called Toxic Talk, How the Radical Right Has Poisoned America's Airwaves. How long did it take you to write a book like this, Bill?
I have a rule. This is my fifth book, and I have a rule. I give myself 3 months to write a book.
Really?
Some people take years.
Right.
I haven't been diagnosed with ADD, but you know what I mean. My attention span is like that of a gnat, and I know if I don't give myself a real deadline and a timetable, it'll drag on and on and on and on, you know. So,
right.
I was one of those guys in college who never studied until the last minute.
Yeah, I know, I can relate to that totally. But that's amazing, because obviously you had to do a lot of research on this. I read a big chunk of the book, and, you know, I don't really take any political positions, because I don't consider myself a conservative or a liberal. I sort of like see how issues affect me personally, you know, one at a time, and then I take it that way. But I've always felt, especially since getting on radio, that indeed there are mainly a lot of conservative talk shows out there and not enough liberal guys to give the other side. And you made a case of it in your book. And apparently some of these conservatives are extreme, according to you and probably according to a lot of other people who listen to this stuff. Tell us a little bit about the book. What is your approach? What is it about?
Well, I wanted to talk about, first of all, let me just say, you know, I've made a living with that political debate. I love it. I thrive on it. I mean, I did in Los Angeles at KUBC with Bruce Hershenson, if you remember.
Yes, I remember him too, yes.
Came to Crossfire with Pat Buchanan and Bob Novak. So, I mean, I really thrive and love a good, hard-hitting, passionate debate on the issues. And that's why I love talk radio. But what I hear and what bothers me is I hear so much, particularly from people on the right, that it's not a debate on the issues anymore. It's just ugly name calling, you know, the most negative, personal, mean kind of vile that they spew all day long. And I think it debases our democracy and prevents any real discussion of the issues. So, you know, I wanted to take a look at it, and I discovered that you know, as a country, we're probably 50% liberal, 50% conservative, or maybe 40-40 with 20 in between.
Right.
But if you listen to talk radio, and there have been studies documenting this, talk radio, there are 9, maybe 10 hours of conservative talk for every 1 hour of progressive talk.
Right.
So talk radio, I wanted to point out in the book, doesn't really, number one, it's ugly, particularly on the right, and number two, it doesn't really reflect who we are as Americans.
Right. Now, my question is, and it has been for a while, even before I picked up your book, is why do you think that is? I mean, why is there like so many conservatives on there and not enough on the other side?
In one word, it is ownership. Ownership. There are 5 companies that control like 95% of talk radio stations in this country.
Mm-hmm.
Of those 5 companies, and by the way, see, this is nothing illegal. They're allowed to own up to 8 stations in any given market.
Right.
And they control who's on the air and who's not on the air. Mm-hmm. Of those 5 companies, 3 of them are 100% right-wing talk. One of them is 84%, and the other one is 76%.
Wow.
So let me tell you, if you're like me, right, and you want to start a national radio show, I'm on every progressive radio station in the country except one, I can tell you. So I'm on like 59 out of 60 stations. Mm-hmm. There are probably 1,900. That's for right-wing stations, conservative stations.
Really?
But there are only 60 that are progressive stations.
Let me ask you, Bill. You know, some people would argue or say that, you know, the conservative voice has gone to talk radio because it's become the last outlet that they're, you know, really allowed to have a strong presence.
Yeah.
And regarding, you know, to your mainstream media and your news, you know, your television sources. I mean, I've heard that time and time again. And what do you say to that when, and there's a lot of ownership in you know, your stations as well. I mean, your TV stations. So what would you say to that?
I say it's baloney. First of all, and I have been part of the liberal media, right, all my life. I don't feel like we control the American media. If you look at the, and by the way, I've done a lot of research on this too. If you look at the op-ed pages of newspapers where you get the opinion, mm-hmm. they're predominantly conservative columnists today. If you look at television, nobody has the reach of Fox News. MSNBC now has really decided to be the station on the left. Mm-hmm. They get, if they're lucky, they get one half of Fox viewers. And, of course, CNN gets almost nobody these days. So, you know, Cara, the people who say that really believe that ABC News, CBS News, or NBC News are left-wing newscasts. I think that's crazy. I mean, I watch all three of them.
Yeah, but I'm just saying there's been kind of...
And also, they believe that NPR is a liberal broadcast, which it's simply not.
Mm. Yeah.
But if you're
Go
saying...
Ahead, Cara, I'm sorry.
No. And I'm just trying to... Because these are, you know, these aren't going to be new conversations we're having, I'm sure, specifically with you.
Yeah, right.
I don't expect to throw you off your game or anything, but I know people listening have these questions, too.
Sure.
A lot of people that have said... you know, if you're saying that this isn't a direct reflection or it's not even an accurate reflection of the amount of conservative viewers or, I'm sorry, conservative people in the U.S., then why are stations like Fox News not only number one but just dominating with viewership and your talk radio is dominating? I mean, it's not just the speakers and the people that are running it, it's the listeners and it's the viewership. I mean, those are the everyday, those are Americans, those are U.S. citizens, and those are the people that are making the ratings high. So what would you say?
I don't know. Yeah.
As
well,
that being
no,
a reflection
are,
of the of you know the
of course they are. I want to make it clear. I don't want to take any of those. I don't want to take any of those voices. I don't care who they are. Sean Hannity, Rush Limbaugh, Michael Savage, Glenn Beck. I don't want to take any of them off the air. What I'm arguing for is I think we need more balance on the airwaves. And that's what we don't have today. But let me tell you, and in my book, I document market after market where there is competition and where you have progressive voices heard at the same time that these well-known conservative voices are heard. Those stations are making money. In many cases, they are beating Rush Limbaugh or beating Sean Hannity head-to-head. Portland, Oregon, Asheville, North Carolina, Chicago, Illinois, L.A. does very, very well. San Francisco, Buffalo, New York, just Minneapolis, St. Paul. The problem is most markets in this country don't offer any alternative, don't offer a different voice.
I see. So you're saying
you
even if you
want... In other words, you can't compete if you're not on the air, and you can't get on the air if the... conservatives own all the stations.
I see.
That's
but
the
then
problem.
What about, I mean, what about, you know, your news outlets that are on television that we know are not all conservative by a long stretch? I mean, what do you say to that? I know you're focusing kind of on the talk radio aspect.
I am focusing on talk radio.
Okay.
Well, the truth of that is that they have been losing audience. I mean, if you're talking about the network newscasts, first of all, it's a half an hour, which is absurd in a great country like this. That's all it's ever been. And they're losing audience like mad, all three of them. Just they're losing audience as fast as newspapers are. I think that reflects the changing dynamics of the way people get their news and information today, which is more and more online.
Right.
You know, talk radio is actually growing, but television news is not. You know.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Well, going back to
cable news. Even is getting is more and more opinion and less and less news.
That's yes, right. But you said balance, and I mean it sounds like a great word in theory. I like the word balance. I like it. I think a lot of people like it, but it's like, let me ask you, Bill, when you want to go about achieving balance, you said having more opportunity in the talk radio, you know, venue for there to be liberal shows. Is really what you're saying. You're saying I'm not trying to take away conservative talk. I'm trying to make more opportunities for liberal shows. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
Okay.
Right.
Well, then
yeah.
I guess it kind of goes back to, and you're saying some of its ownership. I'm just trying to clarify so that I get this. It takes me like a 3-year-old. Okay. So, yeah, I'm just mad. So what you are saying is, but you're also saying that their station ownership, which is really what you're finding to be kind of the block of not allowing liberal voice, and you're saying you want balance.
Right.
But I also am curious about supply and demand. I mean, I kind of feel like if you build it, they will come. And I kind of feel like the stations that are putting out there, you're saying that they are thriving.
Let me just give you one example, okay? I mean, you're absolutely right.
I'm really just trying to recap so I understand where you're coming
from. Let me just put it this way.
Sure.
Let's remember, we're talking about the public airwaves, right?
Uh-huh.
You and I and every American and everybody listening to your program, we own these airwaves, right? The people that run them get a license to run them. They don't pay anything for that license. They get a license for free to make lots of money from our airwaves. And there's one rule, and the rule says, I'm not talking about the fairness doctrine. This is an existing rule for the FCC. It says you have to operate these airwaves that you get for free, that your license. You have to operate it, quote, in the public interest.
Right.
I would argue they're not. At the station that has a company that has 300 radio stations is not operating in the public interest when 100% of those radio stations are all right wing.
Right.
So look at it this way: the last election, 53% of Americans didn't vote for Barack Obama, all right?
Mm-hmm.
So 53% of Americans, for the most part in this country, they don't hear anybody on the radio they agree with. All they hear are these right-wingers. That's
right.
Not, I would argue, balance. That's not in the public interest.
Right.
So just think there should be some, you know, I think owners should be required to have more of a diversity, if you want a different word, to reflect who we are as Americans.
Right.
Yeah.
That's
now,
my argument.
Now, in your book also, I mean, not only do we talk about this, but you also discuss how extreme some of these opinions are and name-calling and all that. Why don't you give us a couple of examples on that? Because I know they're all guilty of it, you know? I mean,
I'll give you two that pop into my head, okay? I mean, one is, there's a guy we haven't talked about, Neil Bortz.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty big. He's got probably 300, 400 stations. All not quite Glenn Beck size, right? But pretty big.
Right.
Out of Atlanta, you know. After Katrina, Neil Bortz said, "Who do you blame?" Well, some of us might have blamed, you know, Bush. Some might have blamed the mayor down there, the governor, whatever. Neil Bortz says, "You blame the worthless parasites who lived there, who didn't have enough sense to wipe themselves, let alone get out of the way of the water when the levee broke."
Mm. You
know, I mean,
to wet themselves? To what?
Provides much insight.
Yeah, right.
I'll give you another one. Michael Savage, whom I think is the absolute most vile and the ugliest of all, out of San Francisco. This was on MSNBC. He had a talk show for 1 month on MSNBC. I warned them not to hire him. They did. And he had a caller, identified himself as a gay man, and Michael Savage said, "Go choke on a sausage, you pig. Go get AIDS and die."
Really?
That's awful. That's so bad.
That's the kind of stuff
I'm talking about. You know,
Bill, I'm curious, though. I mean, I'm not trying to defend comments like that, because, I mean, when you read it verbatim, you're like, oh, that's disgusting and awful. And
when you hear it, it's disgusting.
It's very, it seems very intolerant. But I've also heard a lot of, you know, left-wing people take quotes from the right wing, and when I've heard them outside of context, they sound awful. When you hear them in context, a lot of times these are like, they're not informative shows or more where you get straight news. They're more commentary, and their personalities in it, and it's supposed to be sarcastic. It's supposed to be kind of funny because they're also entertaining, and that, you know, using in taking it as though this is just a straight news show, and then reading the comment, it doesn't even fit. It's like out of context. Now, I'm not defending what you were saying as far as the Michael Savage thing. I don't really know how that would ever be funny. But I also see it kind of goes both ways. I mean, don't you see that the left does that at all as far as some of the name calling and the sensationalism?
You asked two different questions there. Number one,
go for them both.
again, I listen to hundreds of hours of talk radio on the left and on the right in writing this book. And let me tell you, yeah, and I say that in the book. Occasionally, I or anybody, you know, who has got a microphone is going to go over the line. Occasionally, you'll hear that on the left. It is full time. That's all you hear on the right, day in and day out, number one. Number two, anytime somebody says you took it out of context, you know, my response is, you tell me in what context telling somebody to go get AIDS and die is okay.
I'm not defending that, actually.
And I would say that's when they shut up because they don't have an answer. And I mean, the other thing I want to say is in this book, you know, a lot of people don't like the book, but let me say it. Nobody has said that I quoted them incorrectly or out of context.
Oh, really?
Because I sat at a computer, I listened to their broadcast, I re-listened, I typed it out word for freaking word.
Right.
Yeah.
Every quote in there is absolutely correct.
Well, I'm not, first of all, just to get the record straight, I'm not defending that statement. I've just seen a lot of people take quotes from people that have
a commentary
show that's not straight news.
Yeah.
It's commentary.
No.
And their personalities in it, and they're being jackasses, but it's part of their shtick.
Right.
And then they're trying to bash them, but they have the freedom to do that. That's what I'm saying.
No. Of course they do. We're not talking about taking away their freedom of speech. No, I hear that all the time. And sometimes they may be right. Most of the times, it's just a lame excuse because they said something they should never have said. And instead of just fessing up and say, oh, I'm sorry, I went over the line, you know, they give you this BS. Oh, you took it out of context.
Right,
you know?
Right. But I have to emphasize that in the book, Bill has many quotes and they're verbatim of, you know, of what was said. So it's not like just Bill's opinions, but he's actually giving you, he's giving you the quotes, and you just sit there and, you know, I was reading this and I said, oh my God, I can't believe these people are saying these things.
Well, and I'm not really there to defend that. I was bringing up more of a different point of how it's like, I'm sure Bill went, I mean, Bill, you seem like a very, you know, you got your stuff together. I don't think you're necessarily coming from that angle, but I know that a lot of people do, and I'm bringing it up to bring quote unquote balance to the conversation.
Oh yeah, no. That was a total legitimate and good question.
And personally, you know, I mean,
I've
been on other shows and I've listened to several shows, and I think sensationalism on either side. I mean, if you're really trying to get people to hear you. One of my arguments is leave out the name calling, leave out the sensationalism so people can hear where you're actually coming from. Because I think, unfortunately, what some of the right wing does is that they kind of go to the coined phrases and it's funny and it's cute or whatever, or maybe it's harsh, however you look at it. But I think what it does is it turns off people that are really looking for answers, that are maybe in the middle somewhere, from actually hearing what they have to say, because they just look like freaks sometimes.
I have to tell you, on Crossfire, which I still think was the best political debate show on television, and it was on 19 years. I was only there 6 years, so I'm not saying I was the best. I think the show was the best. But in the six years that I was there, you know, again, Bob Novak, Mary Madeline, Pat Buchanan, John Sununu, really some heavyweight conservatives, and we had a show every night of the week, right? Twice, I remember, distinctly, twice. We had a case where a debate got personal, and each time we recognized it, and we had a little meeting, and we said, you know, this is not what we want. This is not the way it ought to be. Twice in 6 years, as opposed to day in and day out. So it doesn't have to be that way.
Right.
Yeah, I agree.
And, you know, and I definitely recommend for people who don't quite buy this to actually read the book and get some of the examples that you bring up, because I've always wondered why there's so much conservative and not as much on the other side, but it does get personal, and I think sometimes it's totally out of place the way they address politicians and fellow talk show hosts and so forth. So I definitely recommend the book. The book is Toxic Talk: How the Radical Right Has Poisoned America's Airwaves by Bill Press. Bill, do you have your own website we can visit?
Yeah, it's BillPressShow.com.
Okay.
And if people want a signed copy of the book, they can get one there. But that's my radio show website, BillPressShow.com. And, you know, we keep it up to date with the guests that we have on. I do a little commentary every day, and I think it's a pretty good website. Check it out, BillPressShow.com.
Sounds good. And I definitely recommend the book for both conservatives and liberals. Bill, thank you so much for taking the time this morning.
Hey, thank you, guys. Great to
Thanks,
be with
Bill.
You. Okay, good to be back in L.A., just by phone.
Yes, sir. Take care and all the best to you.
All right. Thanks. Thanks, Kara. Thanks,
Bye.
Sam.
Bye-bye.
Okay, Bill Press for you. And well, I for one have always liked him, so I'm a little partial there.
I definitely want to read the book. I'm not buying that.
Check it out.
I'm not buying that liberals are victims and that, you know, conservatives.
I don't think it's about victims.
No, I'm gonna read the book.
Yeah.
I think you have
to read it
to,
and see.
Yeah,
what it's
I definitely
about,
no. I'm
know?
Just saying I don't. I'm not necessarily buying that. You know, there's some kind of strong arming liberals out of the talk radio. I think that there's a lot more to it, but I will read the book because it sounds like he's got a lot of points.
Yeah, so. And it's very interesting. You know, and like I said, I'm not that into politics, but, you know, being in talk radio and everything, I found that it was very relevant and it very interesting, if nothing else, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and he's a really nice man.
Oh, yeah, I love Bill Press. He's nice on the airwaves.
You're very nice.
Yeah, he
super
doesn't
nice
come
man.
Across as a...
No, he seems really respectful and cool dude.
All right, we're going to take a short break. I think our guest is here, and we'll be back right after this.
For the most entertaining talk anywhere, stay tuned to LA Talk Radio, your real talk station, your real 24 hours of commercial-free programming.
I've been trying to find a situation to straighten out my life. 'Cause in every part that I've been playing, something isn't right. Cause if what you do is a good feeling, working from your soul, and the love you give to the thing you do can only make it grow.
Oh. world where shitty talk radio proliferates the internet, two people have teamed up to save the world. It's Sam and Kara in the morning, only on LA Talk Radio.
All right, and we're back, and we have Christopher Rice in the studio. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning. Good morning. Good morning.
And you've been on the station before, huh? On Tony Sweet's show and on Terry LeGrand's show.
Yeah.
You've been here.
I feel like I'm in this building at least four times a month.
There you are.
That's a good feeling.
Well, obviously, we love you here. That's why we keep bringing you back.
Well, thank you.
So that's cool. Did you have to drive far? I mean, are you around here?
No, I'm right over the hill, as they say.
Oh, really?
We're in the valley right now, and I live in West Hollywood. I've lived in West Hollywood for about 9 years now.
Really?
Yeah.
Are you originally from L.A.?
No, I was born in New Orleans. I grew up... I'm sorry. That's not true. I was born in Northern California in San Francisco, and we moved to New Orleans when I was about 10 years old. It was 1988. We got there just in time for the Republican convention.
Oh, really?
And the look on your face, I could tell it's not your cup of tea, huh?
We weren't hippies. I mean, my parents were adamant. We were not hippies. They were never hippies, even during the 60s. They were more beatnik artist types. Mm-hmm. But we were coming from probably the most liberal environment in the country at the
time.
Yeah,
that's like a huge contrast.
Yeah, and I mean, it was just where everybody hated Ronald Reagan with a passion, and I was too young to really know why.
Right.
And then suddenly we're in New Orleans, which is a very eccentric place, but a pretty conservative place politically.
Right, yeah. Definitely. And your parents have lived there, what, for the rest of their lives, pretty much?
No, actually, when my father passed away, my mother decided that she could live anywhere she wanted in the world, so she decided to move out here.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Telling.
Yeah, originally she lived in San Diego, and then she kind of got sick of the coastal weather there, the kind of the weather we're having right now, this early morning gray. Uh-huh. And she said, I want the most sunlight I can get. And I said, well, that would be the desert. And so she's been in Rancho Mirage for about 4 years now.
Really?
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
And your mother, for those who don't know, is Anne Rice, mm-hmm. the one and only. And she's probably like, I mean, now we're all into vampire movies and books and all that stuff. But she really started this. Right?
She kind of reinvented it, really.
Right.
I mean, vampires weren't taken very seriously. There was Dracula, and then there was sort of I guess I Am Legend, which was around as a novel for many years before it was made into the movie with Will Smith, mm-hmm. was the opposite, where it was vampires sort of as zombie monsters.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So the idea of the vampire as a tragic hero was something that she really invented.
That's true, yeah. Like, what was the, was it conversation with a...
Interview with a vampire.
Conversations with God,
well,
actually.
You can see
difference.
How much I'm into vampires. But,
no, yeah. But I mean, I remember my stepmom, who was nuts, by the way, but, you know, she was really into your mom's books and stuff.
Oh,
I started reading them, though, when I was young, too, because it
Did
was
you?
The romantic. I mean, like, there's a romance to these novels. They're just really
sure.
luscious.
Right.
And
she kind of made them, like, sexy and stuff, in a way. And that's how they're presented now.
Yeah.
Right, you know? So you're right. She did reinvent it. In the sort of way where we view it differently, I think, now. It's, like you said, a sexy thing, you know?
There's kind of a different kind of... I don't want to say erotic, because it's not really so much erotic.
Romantic,
it's,
really.
It's really, there's a romance, mm-hmm. and not as in, like, romance novel, but a romance to kind of a tragic, like you said, the tragic hero. And and when you said you guys moved to New Orleans, I mean, obviously that made such a fit. I mean, there's kind of like a tragic, slow decay.
Yeah.
There's like a slow, timeless decay. Weird decay in New Orleans, I
right,
think.
Absolutely.
And it's like, I think that your mother's books kind of embody that as mm-hmm. being one of the, its own characters would be, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
New Orleans.
Sounds like a great place to have those kind of, you know, stories and stuff, because it is sort of like mystical and, you know, about, you know, New Orleans and all the South and everything. So I think it's definitely, you know, like a great setting for these kind of stories. And
sure.
That.
Now, obviously, we're here to talk about your book, not your mom. I'm sure you're like, damn it, my mother!
Well,
get away!
I'm sure he's used to it.
Yeah,
by
he's,
now, but,
yeah, he's being
but
very
we're
grateful.
We're talking about his background.
But I want to know. But I do. But I'm not finished. I wanted to set that before I continue to talk more about your mom. Like, growing up with this mom who's writing these crazy hit, these best, you know, bestseller books, mm-hmm. and kind of, you know, like you said, the founder of the new vampire. What, growing up, go for it. You know what I'm trying to say.
Well, it was interesting because when I was a little boy, when I have my first memories of her being a writer, Interview with the Vampire had actually not done very well as a novel. Mm-hmm. And she was trying to strike out as, I guess, a more literary historical novelist. And my first memory of her publishing a book or getting a deal accepted was for a novel called Cry to Heaven, which was actually about the castrati in Venice. It was a historical period piece about, well, we all know what castrati is, I hope, because I don't want to have to say what they are. But they're boy singers who are undergo a certain medical procedure to make them sopranos. And it was very well reviewed, and it didn't reach the audience that she hoped it would. And so she thought, I'm going to go back to vampires. And so what she did was she went back to a character who in an interview with the vampire had been kind of the villain, and that was Lestat, the vampire Lestat, and he became the hero of the series. So she went back to this world she had visited already, but through a totally different lens, and she made a hero out of a villain, and she brought it into the contemporary world. She had this premise where Lestat had gone to sleep for many years. She made up this thing where vampires sort of go into a slumber if they don't feed, but they don't die. And so that is how the books, I mean, that was the book that really... Well, I don't want. That's actually not true. It was a very successful book, but the book that knocked her out of the park was the sequel to that novel, which was The Queen of the Damned. And they were selling The Queen of the Damned out of the box in the store.
Wow.
It earned back a six-figure advance in 24 hours.
That's amazing.
Crazy, yeah.
You know,
that's
and
amazing.
That it was one of those things where it was word of mouth. We don't have internet marketing the way we do today. It had spread.
Says a lot. That says a lot.
Yeah. Mm. I mean, it was really earned, and it was really amazing. And so when that happened is when we moved to New Orleans. So our lives changed very much in conjunction with her success.
Right.
I mean, everything about our lives did.
So how long did you live in New Orleans?
I lived there a while, it feels like, because I tried out a couple good colleges, and none of them took. I couldn't quite get out of New Orleans. I couldn't pull my hooks out. Because I had a really great life there, obviously, and she'd been very successful, and so we had this big, beautiful house, and all these people working for us, and I just didn't want to go live in a dorm and do my own laundry.
Yeah, I can't blame you.
Yeah,
that's what I was going to say. I mean, your mom made it. You guys are probably living nice. It's probably hard to kind of unplug, huh?
It was pretty hard. It was pretty hard. But what happened was I fell in love with California. That's what happened.
And
I
that
came
happens.
Out here for a visit, and I said, at the time I was... pretty decided I would be a screenwriter or I would pursue that. And I came out here to visit a friend, I think I was here once when I was maybe 6 years old. And I visited him, and I realized right away I had fallen so completely in love with the city that even if that never worked out, I could still live here. Which is rare, because I find most people hate L.A., and they're here for a very specific reason.
You're right.
You know, and they're like, as soon as I make enough money, I'm getting out of L.A. I love L.A.
Yeah.
I do too.
I know. We were just talking about it, because we were both on vacation.
We just got back from vacation, so we're like, woohoo!
Yeah, and it feels so nice to be back, you know? So it's nice to hear someone who's actually... got positive things to say about the town.
Sure,
you know?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. As my good friend Eric Charquin, the writer, says, particularly to people from New York who complain about who live here but complain
all
the time, a plane leaves every hour.
You know, that's a good point. I want to say that to people that hate the U.S. that live here. I mean, not to get too political.
Uh-huh.
Plane leaves every hour, actually.
Yeah,
there you go.
More than every hour. If you're,
yeah. Actually, yeah. Yeah. And you get probably get some peanuts and get a nice drink, get a stiff drink on your way out.
Yeah, that's totally.
Yeah.
Don't let the door hit you where the good Lord splits you. I love that song.
Oh, that's good. I've never heard that before.
Don't let the door hit you where the good Lord splits you. Anyway, but that's a plane. Doesn't apply. But whatever.
Right.
Back to you.
Yeah.
So
did you know at an early age that you wanted to write?
No.
No?
No, I thought I was going to be an actor.
Really?
At an early age. And I was a big theater kid in high school. And I think when I applied to college, on my applications, I said I wanted to write material for myself to perform in. Mm-hmm. And that was the only real writing ambition I could conceive of. It was all about supporting some sort of performance career.
Mm-hmm.
What happened was when I went to Brown University, nobody there was really dead set on me being an actor.
Mm.
I was, but they weren't.
That's really funny.
I mean, part of it was I was a freshman, and maybe if I had been a little patient, but I never got called back for any of the plays I auditioned for. It was very humbling at the time. But what I needed was a creative outlet because it had been taken from me. And what I found was I could sit at the computer and enter this completely, to me it was magical, world, and I didn't need anyone else involved.
Right.
You know, at the time I didn't need it published, I didn't need it performed, I just needed an outlet.
Mm.
You know, and so it was me and those worlds and the computer, and that was it.
Yeah.
And after about a year of doing that, I mean, it was sort of Brown, you can kind of take whatever classes you want.
Mm.
And so I think my second semester, I was sort of, I had my eyes on a school where there was a practical screenwriting course, which is what I thought I would do. And so I think my classes were like art, the philosophy of something. I don't remember what it was, but we just talked about it a lot. And an architecture class. I was like taking three classes because I had decided I needed to be in NYU at Tisch School of the Arts. And then I went there, and it felt like going to school, and it didn't feel right for me. And it's a great school. I shouldn't trash it. But basically, I wanted to be back in New Orleans and drinking more. So
that's a good reason.
I think for some people, like going to college right out of high school isn't the best fit.
No,
like
it
they
isn't.
Need to do what you're doing. Like is go right. find yourself, go backpack, go drink in Bourbon Street or whatever.
Right.
Or whatever. You need to kind of get into life first. I know for me
Absolutely.
It was like that.
My father was a college professor for many years, and he said nobody should attend college until they're 25. That they should go out and experience the world and work and get their hands dirty doing something, and then they should come back. I mean, I fantasize. I don't have a degree, and I fantasize about doing it now, and I know I would do it in a subject that I really loved. It wouldn't be about...
And you do real well as well,
I hope.
Because, once you get out of high school, you don't want to do any more school for a while,
Screw it.
So many people are there not because they want to, but because they have to, and that's why I have
and
to
And society tells you,
if you
want a job, it's what you got to do.
Yeah.
And it's weird because I had the pressure when I was in, I grew up in Texas, is that, if you don't go right now, sign up right now, you're never going to go. And that was the concept. So you have this fear. So here I am, and I do music and stuff, and I was some junior college, but I was a vocal performance major. I was like, what the hell? This ain't any fast track to fame. This isn't going anywhere. I don't know what I'm doing. And I was like taking classes like, this all sucks. I have to show up on time. I'm like, I was like, I know how to add and subtract and, read. I'm good. That's all I need in life.
Right.
And so I packed up the goldfish and went to LA. But pretty much it's the same thing. I was just like, I can't sit still. I can't do this. I'm not feeling it.
Yeah.
I'm not feeling it. It's not for me.
Yeah.
Well, if you look at it closely, it's all part of a life schedule that a lot of people don't like or really buy into anymore. Because you're going to college when you're going to college, because you got to get married when you're going to get married, and you got to have kids when you're going to have kids. It's all about this ticking clock that I think drives a lot of people out of their minds.
I think it is like when I called home and my dad's like, "You're getting married." I'm like, "I'm sorry, when?" You didn't even call me on my last birthday. I'm going to have a grandkid, so you'll see him once every 3 years. That makes you happy. Like, what?
Right.
And women, women are made for so much more than just, procreation. But it's just still a mentality of, I'm like, I'm sorry, I'm on a hit radio show right now, people, and I'm kind of living in L.A. I don't know if you know what that means. But anyway, there's still that feeling of, this timeline is what matters more to people than going off and exploring and voyaging, So
yeah, absolutely.
I relate.
No, you're right. And there is that sort of like a script being written for everybody. And, I know that when I went to college right after high school, I didn't do very well. So I decided I'm going to drop college for now. When I went back, I was 27 years old. And you know what? I graduated with straight A's. With honors and everything, because you're more, you approach it more like a business, in a more professional way. So I have to agree with what your dad said. Absolutely.
I think that's very smart.
Yeah.
Tell me to keep telling people that.
Yeah. So you say that you never actually finished college, right?
No, I didn't.
So now this writing thing, do you think it's sort of like a genetic thing? I mean, do you think it's in the genes where you have the predisposition for it?
I do. I do. I think it's like a disease or an illness. It may predate schizophrenia. I don't know. Here's hoping it doesn't. It is something that you can't avoid doing if you were meant to do it. I mean, that doesn't mean that you'll necessarily get paid or that the publishing industry is fair or they will recognize you. But people who have it in them, it will out eventually.
Yeah.
And it was a strange thing for me because I had made so many decisions about who I was going to be and what I was going to be doing that just sort of fell away in the face of life because I said I would never write a novel. It was just going to be too hard. And I like screenplays because really, while I had always been a voracious reader, I was really considered myself to be a child of the movies. And I thought that's what I'll write. And there was also less words involved. And it seemed like everyone else had to do the really hard part, which was filming it. But what happened for me is that I had actually moved out here with a friend after having really sort of permanently dropped out of college. And we were working on all these screenplay ideas, and then my mother got very, very sick very suddenly. She was diabetic, and she didn't know it. And she went into a coma and was hospitalized, and they called me and said, "You need to come." And so I dropped everything I was doing, and I flew to New Orleans, which is where she was still living. And it was pretty clear by the time I got there that she was going to come out of the woods. Yeah. But I had no desire to hop on a plane and come back to L.A. anytime soon, primarily because Mardi Gras was coming up.
I see. Yeah, I like this guy. I like the way he's thinking.
It's not so much about my mom.
It's a fun vibe. But
So anyway, so I needed something to work on, you know, in my downtime. And there was a lot of downtime because she didn't want me hovering over. I used to tell the story like, so I went home, my mother almost died, and I started writing a book. And everyone's like, did you go visit her? Yeah, I visited her a lot, but I needed something to work on. And I had this short story that I had written basically for the sole reason that a friend had asked me to write something original for their reading series, which was fiction only. So I had written this piece, and it had just been sitting there. I had gotten a great reaction to it when I'd read it at this series, but I didn't really know what I was going to do with it until circumstances lined up. And there I was, and I played with it a little on the first day, and then a little more on the second day, and the third day. And I just kept adding to it. And after about 3 months, I had a manuscript. Now, it was not ready for publication by any stretch. But I had finished something that was the length of a book, and that was a real breakthrough for me. That was the beginning.
Yeah, yeah, wow. So when was, how old were you when you wrote the first one?
21.
21, wow. Yeah. That's amazing. You see,
screw college. Just
write a novel.
Yeah, it's good, though. Yeah, I just get that novel on. I mean, if it's in you, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do it.
So which was the first one you wrote? I see you've written, what, 5 books?
5, yes.
5.
This was called A Density of Souls, which everyone called A Destiny of Souls, including Rosie O'Donnell when I was on her show.
That's funny.
A Density of Souls. And it was really, I mean, I have to say, it's hard for a writer who gets to work a lot not to turn on their earlier work, because you read your first book and you think, oh, God, if I knew then what I know now about structure and dialogue and characterization. I think, in part because I had a very famous last name and it helped to get me published very early, I have sort of developed my talent in books that have been published, which is a weird thing to do.
Yeah.
Hopefully I've grown a bit, but it's happened in the public eye. So when I look at the first book, I think, oh God, I was so young. But there are things about it that people just love. I mean, it's wildly entertaining. There's not a wasted word in it in terms of pace. I mean, it just rockets right along.
Really?
And you know what? I was out to shock and to titillate and to move people. And I think for a core group of readers, it did just that.
Really? Now, what was that book about? Tell us a little bit.
Well, it was essentially about my high school experience. If it had been exciting, dramatic, and sexy, which my high school experience really wasn't any of those.
Is that kind of like the Twilight series then?
Yeah, a lot more exciting. Meyer and I have different dreams about our high school experience. This was really about a group of friends who were torn apart by the fact that one of them came out as gay, essentially, or was outed as being gay. And it's about how they're brought back together when they discover that their friend's suicide was actually a murder. So it was not, and I was very clear about this from the beginning, it was not intended to be some sort of realistic, gritty, literary novel about high school or gay kids in high school. It was supposed to be an adrenaline-fueled, over-the-top, emotional thriller.
Yeah.
You know, and it's an insulting term, apparently, to call a book a potboiler, but I actually love it. I think it's a very exciting, dynamic term. I wanted to call my website potboilers.com.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah.
That's cool.
So now, when you write a book, I mean, do you... Because I'm always fascinated by people writing books, because, you know, I mean, I've thought about... you know, maybe writing a book or two, but I can't see how possibly, you know, to write something like this and know how it's going to end. How is the process for you? I mean, do you have pretty much the whole story in your head before, or does it sort of like develop as you write it?
I pretty much have, well, I don't want to say I have the whole story. I have the tent poles of the story. I have, the high points that I'm working towards. And sometimes it's about adding material, more material in between those high points than I had anticipated would be there, and sometimes it's about taking it out and just getting to the point.
Right.
I think probably The Moonlit Earth, this most recent novel, was maybe the first novel where I wrote a really detailed, kind of down to the last detail outline. And it worked well, but there are also parts of it that it takes the fun out of it in a certain sense. Some things are really good surprises. I have a whole character in my third novel, Light Before Day, who just sort of walked into the book out of nowhere. I wasn't, you know, he wasn't in any notes or on any outline, and in the first draft I wrote, he just walked up out of nowhere. But gradually in successive drafts, I worked him in and made him a major character. And he ended up being kind of the instigator. He brings this mystery to the feet of this reporter. He wants to investigate it. Mm-hmm. Whereas before, it had happened in a completely different way. So I believe in happy accidents. Not happy accidents, but good accidents.
I see. Yeah. Now, what is your genre? I mean, do you have like a specific one, or do you write about different things?
Well, I think I am in the suspense genre, which mm-hmm. is a kind of a big umbrella to be under, but mysteries are under there, thrillers are under there, horror novels are under there. Mm-hmm. I was pretty much told by people who read the first two books, or I should say the first book, that I was a mystery writer, whether I liked the label or not. Mm-hmm. I think every good book is essentially a mystery, even if they're not mm-hmm. labeled as such.
Yeah.
But I chose to embrace the label wholeheartedly, and I read my second novel, The Snow Garden, was very influenced by the contemporary mystery novelists that I had read, guys like Jonathan Kellerman and women like Patricia Cornwell, and I was mm-hmm. really trying to tell, whereas the first book, A Density of Souls, kind of stretched over years and involved lots of flashbacks and a pretty big cast of characters. The Snow Garden, my second book, really unfolds kind of over the course of 10 days on a college campus, and while mm-hmm. there are flashbacks, they're not quite as far-ranging as the first book.
I see.
And so it was very much an attempt to write the type of book that I was reading. I mean, the one piece of advice my mother has given me that I should have stitched on a pillow or painted on my wall is write the book that you want to read.
Right.
Don't write the book that other people tell you to write that you think is culturally significant, whatever that means, that you think reviewers will like. Write what you're reading.
Right. And that's a creative process, I think. You know, mm-hmm. when you do anything creative, you don't do it because people are going to consume it, but you do it because that's what's coming out of you, you know? Mm-hmm. That's
I feel like I totally relate, like doing music and stand up and stuff. It's like creativity for me, it doesn't come beginning, middle, end.
Mm-hmm.
It can come in like just almost like you said, it can come in the feel of something, like the you want the pace of something to feel
right.
way, or you get an idea for a scene and then you make a whole thing around it, or for me, like doing music, it's not A plus B equals C.
Right.
You know, you try to then kind of tailor it to where people can digest it.
Right.
But I find that it's very wild, and mm-hmm. and that's what's beautiful about it, and that's what
right.
is the outside. I think that's where the outside the box type thinking comes, is that it's not some equation. It's really something that's so internal and has to be organic. Mm-hmm. Very LA word, organic. It's organic right now. My art is so organic. It's certified organic right now.
Uh-huh.
But it's true.
Authentic.
Authentic.
That's the
I like
other
it.
LA word.
I like
authentic.
It. So I want to ask you, you know, with your career now as an author and coming from, you know, being with your mother, do you feel like it has really helped you a lot in your, you know, endeavors?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
And do you... Are you one of those that are, you're like, I just can't get out from underneath my mother? Or are you like, no, it's not an issue?
It's not. Well, it's always an issue.
You hear that with actors and stuff. They're like, you know, sometimes it's good for them and sometimes they hate it.
I honestly think that in some total, the blessings have far outweighed the disadvantages.
Okay.
You know, I've watched with great interest what Joe Hill has done. Do you guys know who Joe mm-hmm. Hill is? Joe Hill is Stephen King's son.
Oh, okay.
And a lot of people don't know that because he worked very hard to be under the radar. For 10 years, he published short stories in anthologies and in magazines under the pen name Joe Hill and not Joseph Hillstrom King, which is his real name.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a very deliberate strategy on his part, and he's spoken very publicly that he was afraid that the minute somebody in publishing found out who he was, they would just look to profit off of his book and they would publish something that maybe wasn't very good.
Right.
So I sit there having done absolutely the opposite of what Joe I wonder if he's talking about me. I don't know. I don't necessarily think he is. I think it was something he, you know, that was organic to him.
Mm-hmm.
But I wonder, well, what would it have been like if I had done things differently? And there were people who suggested to me in the beginning that I use a pen name for that reason, and I didn't do it. And I didn't do it because I didn't like anything about it. I mean, there was one thing, like, of course I wanted the marketing hook involved. But it was my name.
Yeah.
You know, it's not just her name, it's my name too.
Exactly.
You know, my
person,
name is Christopher
yeah.
Rice. So I think there's that. But honestly, if the first book, if everyone had really hated the first book, I don't think they would have come back for any of the other ones.
Mm.
And I think my defense when people really back me to the wall about it, nobody ever really has backed me to the wall about it, but to my face at least.
Mm-hmm.
But my defense is, yes, that can get one book out there, but it can't get 5 books out there.
Yeah.
You know, if you don't have something.
You got to have a following. You have to have readership. Yeah.
You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. And that's why, you know, I mean, you should go ahead and take the credit for it because it is you, you know, and and it's irrelevant. You know, I mean, most people probably don't know that you're related to Anne Rice and the book stands on its own.
That,
you know?
Yeah, I didn't even know until he told me.
Exactly, you know.
I mean, not like I didn't know who you were, but you know that whole idea, it didn't resonate with me right away.
Right.
Which I think is good. And I think, you know what, we've all been dealt different cards in life.
Sure.
It's like, why deny an opportunity that you've been given? It's like some of these kids that, you know, they've been living in such privilege and then they're like, oh, that's so hard. Fucking privilege.
Oh, that's
and I'm like,
just,
get over it. You know, you know, cash it all away the bank and do something great with your life.
Absolutely.
You know, take those coattails and ride them and be further.
Yeah. Right,
don't
absolutely.
Sit around and be like, oh, my latte. It's
yeah,
like, relax.
Be Michael Douglas and not Paris Hilton is kind of my motto. Yeah. You know, like Michael Douglas has been given every opportunity and he's made hay out of all of them.
Yeah.
Hey, that's good, right? When you make hay, that's
I
good
think
thing.
It is. Yeah,
okay.
Let's just go with hay. Hey.
Michael Douglas, y'all. You know, but like there's some really great examples. It's all about your attitude, you know, and you know, people, this is a scary thing that we do. We make ourselves vulnerable. We put ourselves out there. And there are always 100,000 reasons not to do it. For each of us, we can say, no, that's not the right project right now. I don't know if the market will support that. And you can go to the place of, you know, everyone will make fun of me because I have all this privilege. And I had people say to me in the beginning, how can you write about anything of truth just because you've come from a background of wealth, having nothing to do with
and
the fame
just,
and all of that?
I think that's just like class envy and weird prejudice
it was.
As well. Yeah, it's like, okay, ignorance, but whatever.
And that guy was an idiot.
but that's besides the point.
And I could talk trash about how his life wound up. But anyway, I won't do that today because I'm spiritual. But the reality is, yes, there's always a reason not to try. There's always a reason to complain if you look hardly enough at it.
Yeah, I mean, people can tell right away you're very grounded. You don't look like you're, you know, you look like you know what the heck you're doing.
Thank you.
You know, whatever that means. It just, I mean,
walked
I mean,
right in, sat right listen, down in this chair, didn't fall down.
No, I mean, you know, I haven't read your book, but I mean, I'm into it now. Like,
okay.
I'm like, it looks like he knows how to write something. It looks like, and you're grounded. You know what I mean?
That's good.
You're not coming in here like, oh yeah, and so I had a butter knife yesterday, and I looked at my wrist really hard, and I was like, let's write a book. Like, there just seems to be some, you know, when people get it. Do you know what I mean? People get it. It's like people will instantly get, okay, well, yeah, he happens to come from this background, but you stand alone is what I'm trying to say. As
sure.
As opposed to somebody that's just like, they don't know who they are. They don't know what they're made of. Mm-hmm. And they're just like, you know, look at me. You know, whatever. So I'm not getting that vibe from you, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, cool. Yeah.
No,
cool.
That's cool. Now let's talk about the latest book, The Moonlit Earth. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about what that book is about.
Well, it came out of the fact that I had no idea what I wanted to do next. And I went out to lunch with two friends of mine who had visited a Middle Eastern country, which I won't name because of what I'm about to say. And they said it was an open secret there that the ruler of the country was gay. And everyone just kind of knew it, and nobody really talked about it or did anything about it. And that's the way it was. And I thought, wow. I had been trying to work out a story idea in my head about a straight woman who has to go rescue her gay sibling from some dangerous situation overseas. And I thought, here we go. This is the situation.
Here we go.
I've got some villain. And so what started out in my head is this sort of villainous, you know, king essentially turned into this very, if I'm going to give some of it away if I say exactly what he turned into, but he turned into a very different and far more sympathetic character than the sort of cardboard villain I was imagining. And so the book became about, essentially, from there I ended up writing a story about a young woman whose brother, a flight attendant for an international airline, is accused of being a terrorist. And he's accused of being a terrorist because he's over there in the world of this sort of rich Middle Eastern, he became a Saudi guy, and everything he's done has looked very suspicious because the guy is closeted. So he's on the security footage at this hotel in Hong Kong, which is where he flies to, leaving the hotel with one of the guy's bodyguards about 30 seconds before a bomb goes off and kills 60 people. And he's not among the dead, and he's not in touch with his family. So everyone turns to his sister back in San Diego and says, guess what, your brother's a terrorist. And she's like, that's ridiculous. He's a gay American flight attendant who reads Vanity Fair. What are you talking about?
That's
you know,
funny.
She's a little bit more graceful than that. But that's sort of how it plays out, you know. And so it was interesting because, like, I've written books that had gay characters in them in the past, and some were about sex and some were not. And this really isn't. This is about identity, and it's about financial corruption, essentially, because what the young woman begins to discover is that she has lived, or she is currently living off of her very wealthy cousin, who's who's sort of this sort of mysterious financial advisor to private security contractors down in this San Diego community that may or may not be La Jolla, has a different name. And so she starts to see that there's a connection between what's going on overseas and her own family.
Wow, that's pretty cool. So, I mean, all the details and stuff, they happen when? Do you plan this out? I mean, do you have like an outline, or does the story like sort of like develop as you go along?
In a perfect world, if I have the time, I like to write what I call a burn draft, which is a kind of just bleh, you know, I mean, it's and I write it with the idea being that nobody's going to see it if I don't have to show it to them, you know. Maybe if I have an editor I have a good relationship with, I'll say, okay, here's my burn draft. This is not the finished book. I'm going to completely rip it apart. Give me, you know, as many notes as you want to give me, because this is just the first stab at it. And then, so what I did, that's what I did with The Moonlit Earth. I wrote a burn draft. And I think I did show it to my editor. He read it. And then we had a real sort of general talk about it. We didn't get specific, because the idea was I was going to rebuild it from the ground up. And that's when that villainous character began to evolve. He had been this sort of evil, you know. Mm-hmm. And so I wrote a very detailed outline after writing that burn draft.
Right.
You know.
Mm. Yeah. Sounds like a pretty intricate plot. I mean, you know.
Yeah. I've noticed that you've mentioned this a little bit with your mom, and then talking about your books about the villain characters kind of being, you know, really crucial and how they start to take on different faces, or they're not, you said cardboard villain, it's not really that, and then sympathetic, and then the tragic hero, and kind of seeing this villain character have many different faces and different sides, and not necessarily being just black and white. I mean, that's interesting. Is that kind of like a running theme you think you have with in your, you know, your plots and your characters?
I think the strength of a good thriller is the complexity of your villain. And that doesn't mean the nuances of their superpowers or their global reach. It means their motivations. I think just sort of one-dimensional evil villains who want to conquer the world or just to get laid a lot are really boring to me.
Mm. Yeah.
And that doesn't mean you need to come up with some cute pat answer as to the nature of, you know, pathology or violence or all that sort of stuff. Like, he was abused as a kid. That stuff gets really trite and boring. But I think you need to have an ability to depict evil in an interesting way without necessarily glamorizing it, but with, you know, taking the reader by their collar and sort of pulling them into a place that makes them a little bit uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think what's interesting, I wouldn't agree more, is some of the people that I think play the best villains, like in cinema, you know, like Edward Norton, I think, plays a great villain, and, you know, Philip Seymour Hoffman, I think some of these actors, they bring such a human side to, you know, these villains that there's some kind of odd relatability that you have, where it is very complicated, and I think it kind of humanizes them in a way where maybe we would like to kind of go black and white. They're bad, we're good.
Yeah.
And there's something about really the complication that makes it, wow, could that be somebody I know or myself?
Yeah,
in it. And I think that's kind of almost a freaky feeling, but it's kind of gives you a compassionate,
sure,
a little bit more of a compassionate side to looking at these characters.
You know, it's so interesting, talking kind of about the inverse of what we're saying. You know, Jaws turned, I think, 25 or maybe 35 years old, the movie Jaws, this summer. Right. And there was a special on about it last night, and Steven Spielberg was talking, it was essentially the biography of the movie Jaws, and Steven Spielberg was talking about how everybody wanted him to cast Charlton Heston in the lead role of the sheriff, Martin Brody, and his remark was the shark wouldn't survive past the first act. You know, he needed a character, he needed to lower the wattage of that character, kind of the reverse of what we're talking about. He needed just an everyman, he needed someone the audience could just relate to and hang their hat on, and then Quint, the boat captain, became the sort of semi-villainous character that you're talking about, Robert Shaw. So, you know, you make those adjustments in books as well, you know, but I think a lot of times I hear actors say they would rather play the villain than the hero, just for those reasons.
Many of them do say that.
Yeah.
I do. I think there's just, it kind of sometimes taps into, it becomes a more of a web, I think. And I think, like you talked about, really bringing out the different motives and depicting it in such a kind of a layered way, I think it does. It brings a lot of flavor and relatability, as opposed to this is good, this is bad.
Yeah. Right, absolutely.
You know? And then I think some actors really are known for being good villains, you know? Like, I mean, look at John Travolta, for example. He used to be all this, like, you know, always the nice good part and stuff. And now he's come out as this really great villain, you know. And I just saw him in Swordfish the other day again, which did you ever see that movie?
Yeah.
And
Halle Berry naked, right?
Yeah, you know, yeah.
I know you're thinking that. You're like,
how can you forget that? Yeah. But no, so like in that one, you know, it's like you're seeing him and you're, you know, the more you discover it, you go, well, maybe he's not that bad. You know, he's got some good, you know, intentions and that sort of thing. But he's a villain nevertheless, you know. So sometimes the line is blurry. Like you said, you know, it's not black and white always. You know, it's the motivations, like you said, you know. And so that's pretty interesting, you know. What I wonder sometimes is how writers can write about villains and be able to think like in such, let's say, an evil way. You know, it's like how, you know, if
basically,
you've never been,
are
if
you
you've
serial
never been
killer,
a villain,
is what we want to know.
You know, it's like if you're not a villain, like in real life, how can you like think about these things? You know, where did they come from?
Well, I think you look at the parts of yourself that you don't like very much. You know, I think that's not necessarily the specific actions. Like, no, I'm not a serial killer. But I would have to speculate as to what motivates the serial killers that frighten me the most. You know that phrase, if you spot it, you got it. You know, and it's about psychological
like
emotion.
Or I don't like that phrase.
The other one is point a finger and three fingers are pointing back
at
you.
Yeah, I can handle that one, but the other one.
You know, so I was fascinated in the earlier books that I wrote with characters who couldn't let go of the past. Who were driven by jealousy and envy, which I guess are the same thing, who were driven by a desire for vengeance, you know. And I would put their desire for vengeance through the looking glass, because, of course, naturally, the people I wanted revenge against, it was all very fair and just, of course. Yeah. So I would decide what the unjust version of that was, and I would sort of explore that or what I perceived it to be. But, you know, it gets to a deeper issue, which is that because writers aren't, hopefully, not all evil, that we're making guesses as to what really motivates evil people that may not be really that authentic. They may work well in a book or on screen, but oftentimes when you look really deeply at serial killers, you find what they call the banality of evil, where it's just sort of simplistic for them. And it's almost like they lack the emotions that would give them a motivation that we would, you know, understand in a movie. I mean, one of the books that I wish I could unread was a book I read on the Night Stalker, which was a serial killer here in California, primarily here in L.A., who terrified the nation, really. But there, I kept reading it looking for the answer, you know. And there was abuse in his past, and there was, you know, a crazy cousin who would show him gruesome war photos and all that sort of stuff. But you looked at all the circumstances of that, and you're like, you know, a different person could have been thrown in that environment and not become a serial killer. You know, I know people who had that brother. You know, his family was kind of loving and all came out here for his trial. It wasn't, there was no easy psychological explanation. So we're sort of obligated to provide those in our stories a lot of the time. And I think how sophisticated we are with those things is determines our critical reception. But when you really look at the reality, it's disturbing in a different way.
Is it kind of maddening a bit because you don't find the answers? Is it a little bit like you're like, why? And you're coming at it from a place where you feel empathy and remorse, right?
Yeah.
And you're finding somebody that no matter what you do, you're not getting those answers. So it's got to be probably.
I mean, you look at – here's just a one example from the Night Stalker book. When I read that he went – I knew he had been a crack addict. And I thought, oh, well, that would explain his crimes. And then I read, no, he stopped using crack so that he would become a better killer.
Really?
When you read a detail like that, you think, wow. I mean, because that's committed. Not an easy explanation. Yeah. I realize things just got very serious for your morning show.
You're like,
show.
Wow. He's like, you know what? This crack is I need to up
it's
my game.
Getting in between me and killing people. Okay, so like, how do you make that in a movie? Because in a movie, you're like, oh, it's the drugs that are making him.
Yeah,
and
people
and
usually can't. They can't kick the habit. He's like, right. I'm gonna go through my withdrawals because I want to slay some people.
He replaced it with another addiction, which was a horrifying thing. You know? Yeah.
That's nuts, man.
Yeah. So that's, I mean, people who work in this genre, crime writers and mystery writers, we contend with reality like that all the time. And we weigh the question of how we're going to depict it in our books And whether or not we are driven by a desire to fill that vacuum of explanation, you know, to make some kind of sense of this when there doesn't appear to be any in the actual reports of it.
It's like a really kind of sad realization, though, in a way.
Well, you know, it's interesting, too, because I encounter this a lot, which I think the darker a person's subject matter when they're a creative person, the lighter they are in their personal lives. Like, I go to this conference called Men of Mystery down in Orange County where a mystery writer sits at a table. There are like 50 writers, 50 tables. 10 women sit with you all day and have lunch with you and ask you questions. And it's kind of it's great. And we all have a minute to introduce ourselves. And the woman who runs it literally comes around with a microphone and a timer and times you, you know. Mm-hmm. And everyone is very funny and charming in that minute. And every year she says something to the effect of, you wouldn't think these are the people that are writing about terrorist bombing, serial killers, child abductions, crystal meth, you know, all these
people. Crystal meth.
But we're all in such a good mood. Whereas the joke in California, and I know you do stand-up, so don't get offended. If you want to have a really depressing dinner party, we invite a bunch of comics.
No, I actually, I mean,
many of them are.
Yeah, like I don't feel like I'm souls. That, but I, because I'm so much better now. But, you know, they're dark. We call them dark clowns, like sad clowns. It's like they make everyone else laugh, or they try to. I don't know. I just think it's a weird form of therapy that some people get good at.
Right. Right.
You know, and I think it's kind of. I don't even like hanging out with a lot of comics.
Yeah.
It's weird.
Yeah, many of them I think are like tortured souls when you look at them, you know, and then I think they sort of like come out on the stage and presents a totally different side of them, you know. So I hear what you're saying, you know. Mm-hmm. Definitely.
Yeah, that's actually a really funny point, though. It is interesting. Everybody's pissed. Yeah.
Everybody's pissed.
Everybody's so pissed, man.
We're
and it's
all
like,
pissed in a different way.
Yeah, I mean, I've got my issues. You can tune in Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, to hear them. But Pacific Standard Time. But the reality is like, I'm really a happy person, if you can say that, but it's not chic for comedy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like, it's not chic to be like, I'm a happy person. What's going on? I'm just going to have fun on stage. You're going to have fun on stage.
Yeah, right.
You have fun.
Right.
It's kind of interesting, but there is this weird duality with people that, you know.
Yeah.
So I totally relate to what you're saying as far as that goes.
Yeah. Now, how long did the Moonlit Earth take you to write?
Probably about a year and a half. I think the most fun... the most fun part of the process was the travel that I took to research it.
I'm sure.
I went to,
so you went to all these locales that you covered in the book?
I did. I went to Thailand believing I was going to set the entire novel in Thailand. And I got to Thailand and went, oh my God, I can't set an entire novel here.
Why is that?
It just wasn't right for the story that was taking shape. It was a really sort of sultry, decadent place The thrust of the novel was becoming about financial corruption. And I had, because I was on that side of the world for the first time, and I didn't know when I'd get there again, if ever, I had said, well, I have to see Hong Kong. I've always wanted to see Hong Kong. My father wanted to see Hong Kong, but he died before he could ever go. And so this side trip that I had planned ended up being really the bulk of my research trip, because I set most of the novel in Hong Kong.
I see. Well, you see, so you didn't expect it to...
That's pretty cool, though, to kind of go around and just, like, take your little slices of life. Like, you know, I'm not feeling Thailand. Hong Kong.
Yeah.
Let's try it out. I love it.
Absolutely. And the irony, of course, is I think I'm going to use Thailand in this book that I'm working on now, and I don't have to go back.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. That's really cool.
And what about the Middle Eastern country? Did you go there, too, to one of them?
I didn't go there because there's never a scene set there.
I see.
The Middle Eastern country was Saudi Arabia. That's where I decided that my character, Abed, is from. And it was going to be a little too hard to get to Saudi Arabia, and people recommended that I not travel there. Mm-hmm. And I sort of regret it with a little bit of a twinge, because I talk to people, they're like, the advice you're getting is kind of a little bit racist, and it's like it's easier for you to travel there than you might imagine. But I didn't, because I also knew that character was going to be traveling the world on his yacht. And so I knew he was actually running from his family, essentially, not literally, but trying to sort of get out of, away from their prying eyes. So I thought, let's put him in another place. And so that aspect of the research came out of a lot of reading about Saudi culture and the political situation over there and the way wealth is structured in that country.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Yeah.
So you see, Kara, you should write something because you get to travel a lot.
Yeah, and it's a write-off.
Yeah. There you go. Yeah, I'll have to. I don't know if I have the writing chops, but I definitely appreciate people that do have it.
Yeah.
There's just some things.
Yeah.
Like a quadratic formula.
Oh, what's that?
It's something in math and that I failed, and then writing. I don't think they're I'm just saying.
I can't do math. The quadratic formula, that's like, you know.
My point is it's all kind of like that. I mean, sitting down and like having to figure it out.
Yeah.
Anytime I have to figure something out,
Well, the hardest thing that any of us have to figure out is how to get around L.A.
Yeah, there you go.
So, I mean, like, you got that down.
I got it down.
This morning.
Yeah.
I sure did. And you're loving West Hollywood.
I love West Hollywood.
It's such a cool little area.
You live there too, right?
I used to live by the Grove right near.
Right.
Kind of
okay.
where we were talking, like kind of where he used to, where you do live. Crescent. Well,
yeah,
tell
yeah,
people.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah, tell them exactly.
Hey, see, yeah, those apartments, right? Will you nice apartments? You go to the Griddle. Great. Sorry, but I forget. You know, we had somebody else on here that did not. You know, because we're just chatting. And we're,
yeah,
we
right.
forget there's like a lot of people listening.
Yeah, right.
We're forgetting that people do things.
How many people
we gotta
are
track
listening.
Them down, you know.
A lot.
So let me ask you this. Now, this book came out in April, right?
Yes.
Okay. And you're already writing another one.
Oh, yeah.
Really? Mm-hmm. When are you supposed to publish that one?
Well, I am making the decision to write this on my own.
Ah.
I am not making a, cutting a deal at this time.
Really?
Yes. I am. This book is going to be different, and it's going to be special, and I want to... I don't want to have to pitch it verbally to anyone.
I see. Okay, so
I'm
you have to self-publish
pitcher.
It? Is that?
No, I'm not going to self-publish it. I hope, God forbid. I don't want to self-publish it. But rather than cutting a contract without anything written first,
mm-hmm.
which is how I've done it traditionally in the past, I'm actually going to write it and then go in with it.
Oh, so done. You're going to go in with done?
Yeah, hopefully. As
oh,
done
cool.
as they'll let it be. Whoever, if they, you know, cut me a big fat check and say you have to change some stuff, I'll be open to that. But,
yeah.
You know,
so who's your publisher?
Well, this book was published by Scribner.
Oh,
I did two books with them, Blind Fall and The Moonlit Earth.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, five books. Wow. Yeah, I see them all on Amazon here. And the Moonlit Earth one sounds pretty good. You know, I mean, I really want to check it out and stuff. Next time, send it to me before you come.
I know. I'm sorry
after.
You didn't get a book. That was
Sam's
terrible.
Really good because he's the one with the books. I'm the one that just asks a bunch of blind questions. He actually reads them all,
so
too.
So where did you get those shoes,
Ryder Man?
Like, oh, my gosh. So do you eat at that grill? Yeah. Just kind of wing it. But no, Sam is, he reads.
You like to read.
Yeah,
what
I
kind of books
read.
Do you like to read?
You know, just about anything. I mean, I like mystery and thrillers,
yeah.
mainly thrillers. Mm-hmm. Except lately, I've been so bogged down by Jackie Collins. I don't know what happened to me. It's like
really?
One after another. Yeah, I
wow.
sort of like yeah, because she had a new one come out, and then after I read that one, I'm like, gee, let me check out some of the other ones. But it's not something
pleasure.
I'm very proud of. But you know, there you go. You know, sometimes you just want some guilty pleasures.
Absolutely.
You know?
Yeah. Absolutely. I'm a lot of people's guilty pleasure, apparently.
Yeah.
I'm
love that.
Yeah.
Do you have any TV shows right now that you're like really into that you would
oh,
say?
Oh yeah.
Can I guess?
I have to. Yeah, you can guess, but let me put a disclaimer.
I'm gonna get it wrong though. I know it'll.
Okay, guess first, and then I'll use my disclaimer.
I'm gonna guess this, and this is just—it's probably an obvious guess that that I don't know if you like, but I'm just gonna go that True Blood.
Okay, here's the deal with True Blood. No, I'm not watching True Blood, but I've gotten all the discs, and I'm gonna go back. I didn't get it at first. It was a little too soap opera for me.
It's very campy, yeah.
It's very campy, but it is. It is intriguing me to hear about its development. So and a lot of times this happens for me with the show. I have so many shows on my TiVo. I get TiVo guilt and anxiety, and I'll start cutting them, and then I'll say, oh, I cut that one too soon. I need to go back and get the disc.
Okay.
Yeah. If basically the rule of thumb is if I like a show, it's going to be canceled.
Really?
Yeah. With one exception, which was the cop show Southland, which was booted off NBC and now TNT has picked it up.
Okay.
TNT ran the last unaired episodes NBC produced and now they're doing another season.
Mm.
Love that show. I loved a show called Life on NBC, canceled.
Oh, yeah.
I loved a show called Mercy on NBC, canceled.
Really?
Yes. I mean, so really, I'm kind of the kiss of death. You really don't want me to like your show.
That's funny.
But,
that's a good way to look at it.
Shows that have survived that I like In Plain Sight on USA. I'm a big fan of Mary McCormick, and I think that show is fun, and I love her kind of dysfunctional family. Mm-hmm. That's another great show. I'm trying to think one of the other shows. It's funny too. I have friends who work in TV, so I have to stop Facebooking about what shows I do and don't like.
Oh,
like,
okay, yeah.
Well, that show really went off the rails, and I'm like, oh god, Josh is the executive. You know, oh god.
Do you ever accidentally kind of say that, and especially because having a writing background, that people take offense to it, or
I do, but you know, it's interesting because I was at a meal with one of those friends who's pretty high up in the TV industry, and the other two people at dinner with us started trashing one of his shows. And I turned to my friend and I was like, wow, rough crowd. And he's like, this is how TV is. This is how people are with TV shows. It's interesting. Like, they have a possessive attitude towards their shows, like they're owners of them too. And because they're ongoing, as opposed to a book which has been written and published, or a movie which has been made and released, because they're ongoing, they actually... they give you advice as if they're contributing to the development of the show.
Yeah.
And it was an interesting moment for me. And also, I think there's so many cooks in the pot on those things that it's easy if somebody gets up in your face about a TV show you've worked on. You don't have to feel the sole responsibility for what they're criticizing.
That's so interesting.
With me, a book, the buck stops with me.
Yeah. Well, we're talking to Christopher Rice. The book is The Moonlit Earth. Christopher, thank you so much for
coming
in.
Thank
you. We have to wrap up. And congratulations on the book, of course. Thank you so much for coming over the hill. I know it's a big trip and stuff.
Brutal. A whole 10 minutes.
And I'm definitely going to catch the book because it sounds like definitely my cup of tea. You know, I like thrillers like that, so sounds pretty good to me. Kira, thank you so much.
Thank you, Sam.
Okay, you get to go home and get some sleep if you need to.
Yeah, we'll figure it out.
And thank you all for joining us. We'll be back here tomorrow.
You have been listening to Sam and Kara in the Morning, which airs every weekday from 9 a.m. until 11 a.m. Pacific Standard Time, originating from the Los Angeles Talk Radio Studios. If you have questions about the show or would like to inquire about sponsorship opportunities, please direct all correspondence to info@latalkradio.com. Sam and Kara in the Morning is a production of LA Talk Radio. We say what we want.